This is the State of Things broadcasting from the American Tobacco Historic District. I'm Frank Stacio. So we were all taught about the European roots of American history. We all know about the contributions of men like George Washington, Thomas Jefferson, and Abraham Lincoln. And of course, multiculturalism is part of the American story, but it tends to be told as a subplot. And that history leaves out quite a few things. A new book reveals that a century before the English arrived, Africans were already migrating to America, and they weren't on slave ships. The book is American Founders, How People of African Descent Established Freedom in the New World, and it challenges readers to see our forefathers as they really were, multicultural explorers and settlers. We're joined by the author, Christina Parenza Coles. Welcome to the State of Things.
Thanks for having me.
Let's take a step back and take a look at the scope of this book and tell us more about what you set out to do in this book.
Well, for me, it's a journey that began, you know, I grew up as a kid in Miami in the 1970s and 80s, and Miami is a very multicultural place. It's a southern town, it's Caribbean, it's a Latin town, and I was getting a lot of messages from family and school that, you know, racism is bad and Martin Luther King has a dream, but I could see that the dream hadn't come to pass. And so I was very curious about why we have the racism that continues to persist in the United States. And so that set me on a journey that ended in a doctorate in history and sociology. And I had the opportunity to teach at Virginia State University. And while I was there, I came across the examples of hundreds of men and women in history, African-American men and women, who had just done remarkable things in American history. And it kind of went against the grain of the history I had grown up with, which suggested that African-Americans kind of stepped onto the stage of American history as plantation slaves in the 19th century and then into the political arena during the Civil Rights Movement. But what I found in my research was that, as you said, men and women of African descent preceded the English by a century and, in fact, arrived in numbers, before 1820, four times as many Africans arrived in the New World as Europeans, which, put another way, means that before the first quarter of the 19th century, the vast majority of Americans arrived in the New World as slaves.
So, let's talk a little bit about some of that first migration that doesn't get reported. We consider Jamestown the first permanent English settlement, but as you say, there was a settlement in Georgia of Africans who had settled eastern Georgia, which would become part of the United States long before the English got here.
Indeed. So, you know, there was a population of African descent in early modern Spain and Portugal. So it's not surprising that when the Spanish set out to conquer the New World, as it were, that there were African descended people who accompanied them. But in this case, you're talking about the story of a sugar planter, a Spanish sugar planter named Ayon, who set out from Hispaniola, who attempted to establish a colony in Georgia, as you said. This is 80 years before Jamestown. And he brought with him 600 colonists and an unspecified number of enslaved Africans. And we know that the colony was a failure. Ayon died, and many of the colonists died and went back to Hispaniola, but not before the enslaved community mutinied and joined with the native population. So that would mean that the first permanent transatlantic community in the New World was essentially fugitive Africans.
Well, and this takes us back to, let's go back to Spain, because you mentioned the fact that there were a number of people of African descent who were living and working in Spain as free people. And this gets us to some of the ideas about race, particularly in sort of the pre-colonial world, the 16th century Spain, for instance, that may have been different than ideas about race that we have today. So talk a little bit more about the flux and the free movement of people of African descent in Spain in the 1500s.
Well, as you said, there was a significant population of African-descended people in Spain in the 1500s that participated in all different professions and aspects of Spanish life. But just to pull back for a second, I'd like to stress that, you know, before essentially 1800, most of the world's population was unfree. So slavery is a institution that began with the first civilizations and was always a part of human civilizations, and it had nothing to do with race. So in early modern Spain, you do have enslaved Africans who are joining a very multicultural community of enslaved people, as well as free people of African descent, as you mentioned.
Yeah, I think I want to really underscore that because you do in the book. The fact is that not all enslaved people were of African descent in Spain, and not all African people of African descent were slaves.
Well, that's also the case here in earliest Virginia as well, because with the very first English colony in Virginia, the majority of people who are coming to early Virginia, early Maryland, are actually European indentured servants. And there's a smaller population of Africans who are coming from an intercepted African trade. And so you can kind of see the first legislators in the English colonies kind of wringing their hands of what to do with these sort of multiracial ranks of servants who are running away together and having children together and rebelling together, frankly. And so you see the spate of legislation trying to separate these groups racially. And that's the very beginning, I think, that you see of a bifurcated color line. But, you know, in point of fact, one of the very first slave owners in Virginia was Anthony Johnson, who was a man who was born in West Africa and married to an African woman named Mary. And they had children, and they had both white and black servants and were planters. So in the beginning of the American story, it's a very interconnected world as well that becomes increasingly sort of pulled apart into a black, white, slave-free structure that we come to know. But in the beginning, it also was very sort of interconnected, just as it was in medieval Spain.
And we talked about, you talk about in your book, the number of contributions that have been left out of our history and notable Americans left out of our history, including some from North Carolina, like William Gould. Tell us about him.
Indeed. This story came to my attention when I was at Virginia State University, and we hosted what I believe was one of the very first conferences on African Americans and the Civil War. And William Gould IV, the great-grandson of William Gould I, who was a professor of law at Stanford University, came to present at Virginia State, and he told us the remarkable story of his ancestor. So William Gould was an enslaved plasterer in Wilmington, North Carolina. In fact, he is responsible for some of the beautiful plaster work. I think it's called Bellamy Plantation.
Mm-hmm. Yep.
And he
Bellamy Mansion, yeah.
Yes, thank you, Bellamy Mansion. Mm-hmm. And he was many, 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 many African Americans seized their own freedom during the American Civil War, and William Gould was among them. So in Wilmington, North Carolina in 1862, he sets out, I think, with seven other individuals in a boat, and they make it along the Cape Fear River, a 26-mile journey, I believe, into the Atlantic Ocean until they could board a Union gunboat. And Gould goes on to serve with the Union Navy for 3 years. And in fact, all six of his sons follow his dad into military service. Five of them serve in World War I, and one of them, William Gould Jr., serves in the Spanish-American War.
The story of military service is the one also that gets left out of our story, or at least the contribution of African-descended people in various wars, in every one of the wars that the United States or the colonists had fought, right?
Indeed. And so, I mean, if you think of it this way, if you pull back on American history back to the entire New World history, you know, when Spain was populating these first settlements in the New World, they really required a militia. So Spain first called upon people of African descent for the defense of these New World settlements, as did the English colonies, Dutch, French. All of the colonies relied on militia, black militiamen early on. And even though it was outlawed in United States law, in every single military contest, those laws were set aside or worked around, if you will, so that black men could participate and support, give service to every single U.S. engagement, particularly in the American Revolution and the War of 1812, and again in the American Civil War, as you see with the example of William Gould.
Tell us about Sadie Tanner Mozell, who did spend some time in North Carolina. She didn't start here. Tell us more about her.
Correct. Well, I imagine some of your listeners are familiar with the story of John Merrick, who, of course, is one of the primary founders of Durham's Black Wall Street, a very robust economic center in North Carolina in the first half of the 1900s. And John Merrick founded the North Carolina Mutual Life Insurance Company in 1898. By the way, John Merrick, who was born into slavery in Clinton, North Carolina, and works his way up from a bootblack in a barbershop to owning barbershops to establishing this insurance company that to my understanding, becomes the biggest black-owned corporation in the world at some point.
Mm-hmm.
And Sadie Tanner Moselle from Philadelphia, she gets a PhD in economics in 1921 and ends up becoming an actuary in the insurance company for a small period of time, because she returns to her alma mater, the University of Pennsylvania, where she gets her law degree and begins to practice law in Philadelphia. And she marries Raymond Alexander, who I believe is the first black circuit court judge in Philadelphia. Together, they're the first husband and wife legal team in the United States. And they drafted anti-discrimination legislation. And Sadie Tanner Moselle Alexander becomes picked by President Truman to be the first African-American woman to be on a presidential commission in 1948.
Meanwhile, she came to, and she also then worked at North Carolina Mutual, primarily because as an economist, and perhaps among the first, if not the first female to get a PhD in economics, African-American woman, can't get a job. And luckily was able to come down to Durham, where there was a robust financial district, and was hired at North Carolina Mutual.
You're absolutely right. You know, and the book American Founders is chock full of examples of Americans of African descent, men and women, who earned advanced degrees, PhDs in the sciences, in medicine, who were then unable to find work. So that's why you find people like Dr. Everett Just, who was a biologist, a cytologist, is unable to find work in the United States despite his PhD, and becomes the first American invited to work at the Kaiser Wilhelm Institute in Berlin. So you also, there's lots of stories of African Americans with PhDs who have to go outside of their home region to find employment.
Those stories are found in American Founders, How People of African Descent Established Freedom in the New World. I'm talking with author Christina Parenza Coles. She's going to be at Flyleaf Books in Chapel Hill Thursday, June 20th. And, of course, that's at our website, stateofthings.org. So you talked about Sadie Tanner Moselle, a Philadelphian. Another Philadelphian with a connection here in North Carolina is Julian Abel. Tell us more about him.
Julian Abel was an African-American architect who worked mostly in the 1910s, 20s, and 30s. He's from Philadelphia as well, actually, and also went to the University of Pennsylvania to get his degree. He helped to build many of the buildings at Duke University. He designed much of the West Campus, as I understand, and the Duke Chapel. He also designed the Philadelphia Museum of Art and a library at Harvard and about 400 other buildings. But for me, the connection with Julian Abel, besides his work in North Carolina, is his ancestor is one of the key American founders I talk about in the book. He's from Philadelphia. He's descended from another Philadelphian named Absalom Jones, who was born into slavery in the 1700s in Philadelphia, purchased his own freedom, and was able not only to establish an Episcopal church, but becomes a community leader, establishing many civic organizations during the revolutionary period in the late 1700s. So, for example, he organizes black Philadelphians to care for white Philadelphians during a yellow fever epidemic, and then again organizes black Philadelphians to enlist for the War of 1812.
Yeah, and I think this also underscores some of the ways in which these contributions played a part in the actual building of America, that contributions not only in the business community, but also in the military, and the flux, the partnerships that are created. I mean, if we take us back again to the 15th, the 16th century and the 17th century, the story of the people who came to be known as Maroons, those escaped slaves who formed colonies and lived on as independent communities, and then formed alliances with various groups of indigenous people and Europeans going back and forth. I mean, tell us more about them and their the role that they played. I'm talking particularly about what happened in Jamaica.
I think the Jamaica's Maroons may be the most famous, but just to step back for 1 second, Maroons, or as you said, independent communities of fugitive slaves that colonial states had such a hard time subduing, the history of Maroons begins exactly at the same moment at the history of African-American slavery. So in 1502, the first slaves are arriving in Hispaniola, and by 1503, there's letters from the governor back to the King of Spain saying, maybe we should stop this process, because these individuals, these African enslaved Africans, are running away and teaching the natives bad habits, as he put it. So from the very beginning of slavery, Maroons are a huge strain on colonial governments. And in fact, Hispaniola breaks out into Maroon wars in the 1520s. it's you know, over a year the Spanish are trying to subdue these rebel forces. So there's Maroon communities all over the Americas, including Florida, Louisiana, South Carolina, Virginia. But in Jamaica, they are particularly famous because Jamaica's history begins with Maroons, because when the Spanish cede Jamaica to the English, they essentially arm the slaves who they're leaving behind. And so the English are constantly fighting with armed Africans. And so this emerges into two huge Maroon wars, both of which end in treaties, and the British offer autonomy to these Maroon communities, tribute, often in the form of arms and supplies. And this was a real, this had a real impact. I mean, there's a letter between one of the founders of Richmond, Virginia, and the board, a guy on the board of trustees in Georgia, where the Richmond guy is saying, like, look, there's been a lot of trouble in Jamaica lately. You might want to rethink the importation of enslaved Africans. I mean, it really, it didn't end slavery at that moment, but this is, it's a constant erosion. It's a constant resource stress, both materially and, you know, people's lives were lost in these wars that happened throughout the Americas.
And it talks about the struggle that began right from the beginning, that, that African descended people were involved in their own liberation right from the very start throughout the Civil War and now even today. And tell us more about this, why we find it so difficult in the United States today to include the story of African descended people. And it may have to do, and I think you shed light on this, with the role that white supremacy plays in the development of the American Republic. It's essential to what is America today, like it or not. And so this leads us to the one-drop rule and the way in which we understand race in this country, which is why it's so difficult for us to acknowledge the contribution of African-descended people.
Indeed, there's a story I like to tell, which may be apocryphal to try to show up the kind of absurdity of the one-drop rule. There's a story that the president of Haiti, known as Papa Doc, was interviewed by an American interviewer in the 60s. And the interviewer asked, what percentage of your population is white? And he said, 99%. And the interviewer said, I think you misunderstood the question. And Duvalier apparently says, you have a one-drop rule in your country, so do we, sort of playing on this idea of the absurdity of the one-drop rule. But just to circle back, you know, as we were saying, slavery has been part of every civilization throughout human history, and it was justified by the rules of war. It was justified by an ideology of hierarchy which governed most of the world. So my understanding is that once you switch to a purported democracy, once you switch to a Protestantism that is not hierarchical like the Catholic Church, it becomes very difficult to justify slavery. And so I think that in the United States in particular, there's a very difficult contradiction between the civic and Christian virtues of our rhetoric and the practices of this institution of slavery, on which touched every element of American development, economically, politically, culturally, you name it. So I think that race, and in particular white supremacy, becomes the ideology, becomes the rationalization, becomes almost a religion, if you will, to try to justify this institution that really fundamentally goes against the grain of our history.
Well, or with the grain, and the difficult thing that Americans, what's difficult to acknowledge in America today and what is difficult to say out loud, is the fact that white supremacy is the foundation of the American Republic. And we'd like to walk away from that, but it's clear that that replaced the old hierarchies once democracy and, as you say, Protestantism were ascendant. So it's amazing stuff, and I think you shine a light on a very important part of our history, an untold part until now. Christina Parenza Coles, the author of American Founders, How People of African Descent Established Freedom in the New World. Christina, thanks so much for talking with us.
Thank you.
She's going to be at Flyleaf Books in Chapel Hill Thursday, June 20th at 7 o'clock. We've got the information at our website, stateofthings.org. Just ahead, artist, musician Rebecca Newton out with her first solo album after 40 years in the music biz. Can't wait to hear this. Stay tuned.
Never wrong, 'cause I wouldn't have known the courage of your love. The courage of your love, I thank you for.